I think one person who's really bad at something is the saddest thing in the world if they keep doing it over and over again. But finding community in that together is the most joyous thing in the world. You have to imagine the times that are not in this movie where they look at each other, they're like, we're pretty bad at this. Like,
you're listening to the Brightwall Darkroom podcast, where we belly up with critics, artists, and our magazine's contributors to speak from the heart about film. I'm Veronica Fitzpatrick.
And I'm Chad Pertman.
Chad, how are you?
I'm pretty good. How are you?
I'm good. I'm really excited to be back chatting with you after a couple months away.
I know it doesn't, in some ways it doesn't feel like it's been that long, but in other ways it feels like a long time since I've seen you.
I know. Our producer Eli and I were talking before we started recording about how the last time we talked, it was like the very beginning of the summer, and now summer's over.
Yeah, it went fast. You've been some places. I've been right here the whole time. So,
like in front of the bookcase.
Yeah, just reading all my books.
Headphones on.
Just ignoring the world. Yeah.
I have, yeah. I did a creative writing trip in Ireland, and then I went on a little holiday, as they say, in England. And I just got back from a long weekend in New Orleans for my friend's 40th birthday.
Wait, did you see your mom or is that?
That's tomorrow. Oh,
okay. Because I know she's got some movie opinions. Where I was like,
Yeah. I don't have any fresh Herminia takes for you today.
Make sure and collect some of those.
Yeah. I'm not sure what we're going to watch.
Has she seen Top Gun Maverick?
No, she hasn't, because she hasn't been to like a cinema. Yeah, that's a good idea. I should rent it while I'm home.
I mean, I don't want to tell you how to live your life.
No. I will do that. And then next month, I'll let you know what she thought. Maybe I'll record some of her reactions and we can splice that in. Get Minya on the pod, finally.
The long-term project reveals itself.
Yeah.
Well, that's great. I'm glad you had a good time, but we certainly missed our monthly chats. So.
Well, likewise.
I'm glad you're doing well.
Same.
And I am obviously very excited for the movie today that we're doing. I don't want to jump too quickly into that, but at the same time, we haven't jumped at all into there yet.
This is a you pick, yeah.
Yeah, I'm not usually the one picking. Just like last time, I think it was Down With Love, which was how many months ago? Long time ago. I'm always worried about what you thought of it, because this is one of the bits. It's not one you had seen beforehand. If we go with one you pick, then I know we're safe, because I know you probably like it, so... So yeah, a lot on the line for Ishtar, because it's also, as far as I'm aware, the only time we've done a movie that one of us has written about.
Right. Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Yeah. And obviously, I've made no secret of my affection for this movie over the last 4 or 5 years since I first saw it. So yeah, I'm really excited to talk about Ishtar today, but also hopefully some about 1987 and film in general, because that was also a last minute issue change idea. It was really just selfish of me to say, I just really liked that year a lot. And it was also when I was like, a kid, so I just have a lot of fond memories of that, so yeah.
Do you want to say what the rejected theme issue idea was?
It wasn't rejected, it was shelved or pushed down the line.
Okay.
It was honestly, it's kind of a bummer, more so in that why we couldn't do it was it was significantly less fun of an issue than 1987. It was environment and climate change.
Okay.
I think Ethan said something like, I don't know if I'm up for reading any essays on this, let alone, you know, submissions, so... But yeah, in general, like we kind of thought about our own mental health and like, do we really want to be spending a month in that? It's important, but at the same time, there's a lot of important stuff people are keeping up with now. And let's have some fun. So 1987 sounds way more fun.
That's amazing. So you were like, fuck the future. Let's just look back.
Yeah.
Speaking of fun, do you want to introduce our guest today?
Great segue. Yeah.
Oh, thanks.
And I can make it alliterative too, because we have fun Frank Felici here today. Frank, for those of you who read The Sight at All are probably familiar with, kind of burst onto our scene with an essay on Windy and Lucy. And then the one where everyone's like, whoa, this guy's an amazing writer. We want to have him write as much as he wants for us. Was for a Hot Rod essay he did pretty early on in the pandemic that tied in a whole bunch of things. There was something about Karl Marx in there. There was something about that Do Nothing book. I don't I'm messing all kinds of stuff up here. So anytime we see a pitch from Frank, we all get really excited. He's a great guy and a great guy to edit and interact with and work with, and a great writer. So Frank Felici is a writer working in and around movie and image culture, pop music, and the speculative possibilities of both. He formerly was a writer for Tiny Mixtapes, which I loved, by the way, and currently contributes essays on film to Bright Wall Dark Room. Welcome, Frank.
What's up? That was the best like wrestling introduction I've ever had in my life. Here's a fun guy. It's so good to be here. Thank you, y'all.
Fun Frank. Welcome.
Fun Frank.
We're so excited to have you on and to actually get to meet you in real time. That's awesome.
Yeah. Heck yeah. Heck yeah.
And to talk about a movie that it sounds like or looks like on your letterbox you've watched more than a few times in the last couple of years as well.
That's true. That's true. Yeah.
Have we set the movie yet?
You did, yeah, Ishtar. Okay. Right.
Yeah. So we're here to talk about Ishtar.
I love, Chad, when you totally stalk the letterbox.
It's like when I stalk it?
Yeah, like it's like a spoiler for what our guests...
I like that you pretend it's just on letterbox that I do that. Yes, that's the only side I do that on.
It felt loaded.
Yeah.
It felt loaded when I got 3 likes from Chad on Letterboxd. It's like, oh, something's up.
I was doing some research, yeah.
It's the cinematic equivalent of when on Instagram someone likes like 10 pictures from 2015 and you're like,
okay. Yeah, they
okay.
go way back to show you. I'm in deep here.
You're deep diving, all right.
Yeah. But I would say, not just because he's on the show, that Frank's Letterboxd reviews are really fascinating in a way that I don't think many people's are on Letterboxd. They're almost like little mini essay poems in themselves. So they're well worth reading if you want to follow him.
I totally agree. Frank is one of the few people I also follow on Letterboxd. Yeah.
Because I just have no idea what he's going to say or how he's going to say it. And that's increasingly rare in the internet days. So.
Yeah.
Same, Chad. Same.
No, mine are predictable. Mine's like family movie night. We watch this. Family movie night. We watch this.
You want to do a synopsis?
Yes, let's do the synopsis.
Let's do synopsis. A little bit about Ishtar, our movie today. Ishtar from 1987 is the fourth and final film directed by Elaine May, termed Studio Suicide by her longtime collaborator Mike Nichols, for its much-publicized budget excesses and alleged on-set tensions. Dustin Hoffman and producer Warren Beatty are cast against type as Chuck and Lyle, two dubiously talented songwriters who leave New York to headline in Morocco, but are waylaid by competing political agendas in the fictional border country Ishtar. We have Beatty's then-girlfriend Isabel Adjani playing liberation radical Shira, Charles Grodin, RIP, as CIA agent Jim, and we've only just begun composer Paul Williams providing original songs for enough montages, I think, to qualify Ishtar as a hybrid musical. Long dismissed as a box office failure and career-ending cautionary tale, Ishtar has also been critically championed for its singular comedic perspective. Richard Brody, who's a huge Ishtar fan, based on my own Twitter stalking of who I follow, has said what about Ishtar?
Oh, he's huge.
He calls the film, quote, one of the strangest, deepest, funniest, most exuberant, and yet most painful comic explorations of the artistic life that exists. But that pull quote appears in a 2015 New York Post piece titled, I'd rather have a root canal than rewatch this movie.
Not by Richard Brody.
No. So most exuberant versus root canal is like the choice when it comes to Ishtar. Frank, where do you fall?
I first watched this in May of 2020. So
dark times.
I have like a really normal and well-adjusted relationship with this film. I would say still very positive. I think I like some other Elaine May movies more now that I've seen those and now that I've lived past May of 2020. But I still had a good time sitting down with this one.
Chad, you said in the doc that this is you were joking, but we'll go with it, your 474th viewing of the film.
That seemed real. That seemed
I know. Real. I'm like, is it a joke?
It's important to make it a specific number so it sounds real.
Yeah, no, I love that. And then last night, this was my first viewing of the film.
Yes.
So what... what's been happening to you with these repeat viewings? Like, what is getting unlocked? I know you're a huge Elaine May fan to begin with.
Yeah, I mean, that's where it started. Definitely, I'd seen, you know, her other 3 movies. I grew up in, you know, 1987. I have actual memories of being alive when that movie came out and just how much it got pilloried and just raked over the coals. Coolest thing anymore, but I was a big fan of The Far Side by Gary Larson back then, and he had that famous Ishtar comic. I had that in my Far Side gallery book that I'd read every day obsessively. It just was cemented in my mind that this is just the worst. No one should ever waste any time on this. Really didn't even know what it was about. I mean, I knew something about a desert. If it had been framed as like, hey, these are struggling musicians and it's kind of fun, you know, I would have probably given it a shot, but I just had zero interest in watching it. And then I can't remember when I actually did first watch it, but I mean, right from the first, I do think the opening part is by far the strongest, in terms of like just the comedic value and the rhythms and the things are setting up and the kind of tonal changes and things like that. I was just sucked in, and I was just, I think I said it in my essay, like, I was just giggling all the time. I was like, the jokes were so stupid. There's something about the rhythms of the jokes or the stupidity without being stupid. So I really was just sucked in. I was like, this is nothing like I was led to believe it was. And I was like, it must just get really terrible in the end or somewhere in there. But it just kept, I just kept everything about that happened. I was just, and I recognized so many people, even like a random, you know, crowd pan, and there's like Dylan Baker's in one shot, and there's all these really like random like extras who are now actors, and you know, Carol Kane, all that kind of stuff too. Yeah. So I just thought it was really, really, really funny, which is the number one reason. If I mean, I'm trying to intellectualize my main reaction, which was like, I just couldn't stop laughing. Probably more so than, I mean, the other Elaine May movies certainly have humor in them, but A New Leaf, the humor is obviously much more acidic, and Heartbreak Kid as well. And there's so much awkwardness. This awkwardness feels different to me in a way that lets me into it more, if that makes sense.
It totally makes sense.
Yeah. So then, as sometimes is my way, I got a bit obsessed. So started just watching it and being like, well, maybe I was just in a strange mood that day or, you know, whatever. So I watched it again. I was like, no, this is even better. And then I just started watching it. Like, it just kind of became a weird thing I did for a little while. But yeah, I don't know if there's anything, like, there's no big, like, Rosetta Stone. Is that even, there's no Rosebud to any of this. it's just, I laughed. It was funny. And I was like, Elaine May's done it again. and then I also wanted to be somewhat of an evangelist for, hey, people should at least give this movie a chance. You don't have to love it like I do, but you should at least give it a chance.
Yeah.
And then, of course, found out that's the movie that ruined her whole career. And she's never been allowed to direct since, really, except for a Mike Nichols documentary after he died. And so it's just like the travesty and the layers there, all that kind of stuff. So I think the backstory is super interesting in terms of the production.
Yeah.
I think it's a really sad culmination of a really promising career that just did not need to end in 1987. So, yeah. So then I wanted to write about it and then took off. And I didn't watch it for 2 years until last night. So I have withdrawn. So
amazing.
Yeah.
I love your essay on it.
Oh, thank you.
The humanism of the movie is so foregrounded and treated with like such specificity and care in your essay. Mm-hmm. And that was really helpful for me because you assigned me to write about A New Leaf for the Elaine May issue.
Yeah,
I remember. And I liked thinking about it, but I wouldn't say I enjoy that film. And also find it bleak. And maybe some of it is the fact that Elaine May is in the film, which was the cheaper solution as casting herself opposite Walter Matthau. But it's just so much dissonance for me.
There was a lot,
in that movie that here, it's a lot gentler with its characters, I think, this film.
In a way
that I really wasn't expecting or would not have known to expect, rather, had I not read your essay before the screening.
Oh, okay, cool. Well, that's nice to hear.
Yeah, so that was a helpful decoder ring for me, you know?
Good. That's the goal always.
I definitely want to talk about the weird kind of production history stuff, but Frank, I'm curious, you say that in a way the film is situated among May's other work for you. How is that? And how did you like come to Elaine May in the first place?
I think honestly through the Bright Wall Dark Room issue.
Whoa.
Probably, right? Like that was when I started to like pick up on it. And I don't think I watched Ishtar knowing the production history.
Oh,
like,
wow.
I'd read the essay at sometime in the past, and then I needed something like something stupid and funny.
Mm.
And that's what Ishtar was.
Yes, very much so.
Yeah, it's interesting to watch it without knowing its baggage. And then the baggage makes sense. But I mean, I do think it holds up as a comedy and not just a sort of like a Magnificent Ambersons. Like you can see what they were trying. Like, it is sort of the movie I think it was going to be.
Yeah.
And I think to her run, right? It's unfortunate that there's only the four, but you have these two sort of comedies about single murderous men, and then you have these two duo movies about these struggles to communicate. So obviously I wish she had more movies, but the fact that it ends on this resolution in Ishtar of this literal song.
Yeah, I didn't think about that. That's a good way to go out.
I don't think she planned it, but I'm glad.
No, I know. Yeah, no, it wasn't the plan.
Yeah.
But yeah, that is, I guess that's the last cinematic moment, for her.
Yeah,
that,
right.
That montage at the end of Ishtar, wow.
Up till now, right? Because isn't she supposedly directing a film with Dakota Johnson.
There was that Twitter rumor stuff, but...
Elaine May is 90 years old.
Yeah,
so,
I don't think that's good.
Not to express too much skepticism, but I just know... more so, I'd love to do a set visit, I guess is what I'm saying. Yeah. Especially based on like reading all these accounts of why the film was set up for failure, I guess, in the way that it was, or at least box office failure. I mean, it's really, really interesting because there is the stuff, obviously, about the budget, and the numbers are not in my brain at the moment, but they're very Googleable in terms of like...
You lost some money.
Lost a great deal of money, but like lots of films lose a lot of money and aren't written about in the press so extensively and pointedly. So that's really interesting to me. But then I think more interesting to me are the allegations of May like shooting shit tons of film.
Yeah, she always does that.
Yeah, that's a thing that some filmmakers are known to do, and it's thought to be kind of expansive and meticulous at the same time. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're Kubrick or something.
Yeah, Fincher.
And then if it's her, it's just like you're wasting everyone's time. But certainly it has to be both, right? Like it does literally waste everyone's time. Like time is expensive on a film set.
Yeah, like with Kubrick doing like, you know, 200 shots at the same scene, does feel a little bit different temperamentally than I'm just going to leave the camera running for a long time and see if it happens for hours, which I think Elaine May would do it too. So.
Yeah.
And I think it's hard to argue with the idea that she made the most of the footage she got. Mm. I mean, you got to kind of chisel away and stuff. And so if that's her process, that's her process. And I don't think anyone talks about any prominent male director in that way if that's their process.
I think that's true. There's a lot of like mysteries with regard to Elaine May that I have curiosity about, you know, like I have questions about the sort of reputation or aura of Elaine May, how she's written about. And particularly with regard to her, like, sex appeal, or I should say, like, her irresistibility, which is something that comes up all the time. Mm. And surely that, too, is this kind of, like, sexist node of criticism that's like, shouldn't we also talk about how beautiful Elaine May was? And certainly, she's obviously super beautiful, but the fact that that element of her self-presentation and her intimidation of others is always... always kind of front-loaded in discussions of her talent, I think is really, really, really interesting. At the same time, I'm not saying I don't want to hear about it because I absolutely want to hear about it. I mean, the quotes that people supply about how scary...
Oh, and Richard Burton. Have you seen the Richard Burton
one? Yeah, the Richard Burton one is so good. I never want to see that woman again.
If Richard Burton is freak.
Well, he's married to Elizabeth Taylor, who's certainly no pushover.
No.
It's really fascinating to me.
And I do think a lot of that, I mean, yes, her looks for sure. In the 50s and 60s, I don't know how much she was in front of the camera after A New Leaf. Oh, well, I mean, she was in a couple random Woody Allen movies in the late 90s. But yeah, for the most part, she's not been out there very much. Mm-hmm. So I think a lot of that is locked into that image of her. If you ever look at social media, there's about 5 pictures of her that everyone uses.
Yeah.
That's about it.
100%.
But I think the thing that really intimidated people, at least my take on it from what I've read, is how sharp her mind was and how like how intelligent. Like that's the overwhelming part. And then the fact that she was, you know, gorgeous, beautiful, certainly just added to the fact of like, I don't know what to do with this thing. I've got no angle here. This person's smarter than me and better looking than me. And I'm a man. I'm not used to feeling that way. So I'm just going to leave now.
But I think gender-wise, it is really interesting that Elaine May has gotten picked up, at least from what I can tell on the internet, as this like icon put on a pedestal even. Or like picked up off the ground, I should say.
Partially my fault, but yeah.
As this simultaneously like an object of interest for like film bros, shall we say, but also, which I'm not putting you in that category, Jen.
Yes, thank you.
But then also as this kind of feminist, you know, this like forgotten, but shouldn't be forgotten female filmmaker. Yeah. But Elaine May was also like obsessed with making movies about men.
So true.
And there's all these reports, I mean, even around this film of her not getting along with supporting actress Isabel Adjani, who was Warren Beatty's girlfriend at the time that he was starring in the film and producing it. So it's all just, I'd love to know the hot goss behind the scenes.
Yeah, I don't know if we'll ever know that. I mean, I think the Warren Beatty, Elaine May relationship would be a whole book or movie of its own.
100%. I know.
Because they're very involved in each other's lives, but I think only dated really, really briefly, and nothing was ever really made of that. So,
I didn't even think that they did.
I mean, I think they did.
We're going to get roasted.
If only
the rumor starts here. The rumor starts here, Chad. Yes,
they have actually have been married in secret for several years.
I can't wait for our reviews to tank when people are like, they talked about Ishtar and it was all about what Elaine May looked like and who she was smashing at the time.
Yeah, we should get into the movie. It's a great movie. Great.
No, I love that thread, though. I because they're not only about men, right? But they're like, she has such an affection for these men.
Yes.
Like, when you talk about, like, where her sympathies lie, like, she has such an affection for all six of her, like, murderous, dumb, stupidly boring men.
100%.
You have to think about how many of those men she met in her life and was witness to. And, like, how it's coming out in these very sort of small moments in these movies, or rather these movies are these small moments in like American film history. It's wild. Grodin.
I was going to say Grodin, who, by the way, has the same birthday as Elaine May, which is a cool
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Charles Grodin, so great. I just saw Midnight Run for the first time like this past year and have been sort of seeing everything since through the lens of Midnight Run. Like when I saw RRR, I was like, is this also Midnight Run? Like, is every movie Midnight Run?
Have you gotten to Clifford yet?
No. I haven't.
Clifford's pretty good.
Frank, I'm sure we'd love to know some more things that you love about this film, or that like strike you about it, or things that you find like memorable. You have such an amazing, capacious attention to detail in your writing. I'm sure that there's gold in them thar hills.
I think that's a lovely thing to say, and I don't think that's true. I am obsessed with what you write at 2 o'clock this afternoon when you were like, Ishtar's a musical. I was like, oh my God, like that is something. And there's something really to these songs by Paul Williams.
Totally.
And I think it's in your essay, Chad, but like the notion that they had to be believably bad.
Yes, they had to be earworms that were terrible.
Yeah.
And they had to be liked by everyone. Like everyone involved in the songs had to have an affection for them.
Yeah.
And there's something about that word affection that comes through in Ishtar. And of course, right, the final moment of like, I just think they're wonderful. What do you do when you love bad people? Right? I mean, but that's Mikey and Nikki.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the collaboration on the music would be fascinating to read more about, but it sounds like it was quite the back and forth process. I'm guessing there's piles of unused Ishtar songs too. I know,
release them.
Carrie's always advocating to get the actual actual soundtrack's not even available anywhere
And to put it in those boys' mouths, like to put it in the mouths of two men who were like not performers in that sense. And so there's this weird tension between like they're like boneheaded performance of songs. Like, I don't think the actors really get why the songs are funny in the same way that the characters don't get the songs are funny. The weird tension. And I love it.
And there's no condescension. I mean, that's where I finally got to like the humanity angle. Like this is, you could see a version of this movie where it's just like, you know, David Spade and Adam Sandler and look how bad at music they are. But it's never, at least in my reading of it, it's never laughing at them. It is definitely showing you that they are not the smartest people in the world, that they possibly overestimate their own talents and abilities. But I do think that you get those moments when you see that they are aware of that. And I think that that helps break some of that down.
That's really interesting. I don't think they do overestimate their... I think they have a fair estimation of their talent. When they say nice things to each other, they're saying nice things to each other, but they're never like, we're so good, we're going to do this. Yeah. Like, that's their totally real talent is like propping each other up.
Well, there was the bridge over troubled water thing, though.
Yeah.
Like, But I mean, that one was a little bit like, what's dangerous business is as good as bridge over troubled water any day of the week. You know, so
right.
The beginning, anyway, they have some bravado. But.
Yeah, I love that. When you're on, you're on. Like...
all of those things. And again, I love also the collaboration, you know, just again, that they're, if they were allowed to live in their own little bubble, they're very big fans of each other. And it reminds me a lot of how we edit Brightwell Darkroom pieces with writers. We're like, I was like, yeah, we're just like, hey, that was awesome. I mean, maybe it's not awesome, but to me, it's awesome. And I think there's just a lot of that spirit that I think is really cool that's in the movie. And I couldn't find that really written about anywhere. So that's kind of why I took that angle on it. But I'm glad it can help.
Yeah, because most of the essays are just like, it's not bad, actually. Or, nope,
I hate that.
It definitely is. It's just this kind of like yes or no question criticism. But yours is, you know, it's a lot more careful, I think.
But Veronica, you knew the history before.
I did.
Heard of Ishtar?
Yeah, I had heard of it. I didn't know a lot about the production history. I knew it was supposed to be bad. I knew that people liked to talk about it, though, in the vein of Showgirls, a movie that I'm sure you're not surprised to know I completely love.
I'm not surprised at all.
Yeah. So I was like, well, maybe. And I sort of joke sometimes that I hate comedies, which is sometimes a little bit true. Yeah, Frank. Yeah.
That's why I was scared to put it up here. I was like, I don't know.
I feel like I love humor and like hate comedy. I hate like being invited to laugh or like occasioned.
Trying too hard or?
Yeah, I don't know. I think there's something too narrowly call and response to me sometimes about jokes. And like some comedy that's more like narrative and more almost like a therapeutic monologue or something. Like I can appreciate that sometimes. But for the most part, if the rhetorical occasion is like, and then there's a punchline, you're meant to laugh now. And if you're not, then you're missing it.
So it's like rebellious. I'm not going to laugh at
that. A little, maybe a little bit. Yeah, maybe it's a little like undomesticated spectator or something. Like I just don't want to do the thing I'm supposed to do or something like that. Like I would expect, because you said that for you, the beginning of the film is sort of like where it's strongest.
Mm-hmm.
For me too, 100%. While Chuck and Lyle are still in New York, and we're getting the sort of story of how they met. I love how that is structured, how it's sequenced. And I would imagine, because we see them sort of meeting in this, like, what is it? It's like a restaurant with live music.
I literally figured out last night after my 474th rewatch that that's just still part of the funeral that he was singing at.
Oh, fuck. Really?
Yeah, but okay. So don't feel bad if you didn't get it last night.
No, I was like, is this a supper club?
No, because what, and again, it's like, I'm like, how have I missed this all these times?
Yeah.
But he is singing, I wish we could play sound clips on here legally. The wonderful Leaving Some Love in My Will.
Oh, I love
those
that.
Old people.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is just, oh, I can't even.
Genius.
I can't even think about that without laughing really hard. And then he sits down and is kind of talking to his partner about something. And then someone comes over and says, hey, this guy thinks you're a good songwriter. And then it cuts to them in the same outfits at a piano with a guy cleaning up. So my guess is they're doing their We're Really Good Musicians performance stick while in the aftermath of a few.
They're like jamming. Yeah. And if there's anything I hate, it's jamming. And so like
Frank, you're a musician, right? You do some music?
Oh, sure. Oh,
yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm saying, like, jamming's fun. But yeah, talking about jamming or the word jamming is awful.
Riffing, that word riffing is the worst.
Yeah.
Watching people do that is like, ooh, it's not good. That's what I mean, is like spectating. And so I would imagine I would be more in alignment with the perspective of the then girlfriends played by Carol Kane and Tess Harper. And they're sort of in the corner drinking and like watching exhausted, kind of like, when are we leaving? You know,
give me half an hour.
Very like boyfriend on the ottoman at Forever 21. Just like, get me out of here. Candy Crush.
I've seen those looks on, you know, when I was jamming in high school. Yeah, those looks are very, very accurate.
They're very common. Yeah, very accurate. Yeah. So I would think I'd be more like that. But I was actually like completely delighted by those musical montages of them performing and the sort of like little, even though I think I read, and I'm not sure if it was in your essay or something else, that Elaine May was like, no, I want you to write whole songs, even though we're just going to play little clips like in the film. But there should be entire songs, like complete songs, which of course was one of the things that took a lot of time, therefore money from production. But I was like, I'm so happy to hear like the medley of as many of these insane, like secretly wise, very catchy songs as I can.
Yeah, I like that you said secretly wise, because I go back and forth on like, you know, the sound of the lawnmower touches my heart. And I was like, that's kind of profound. And I was like, no, that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard.
I think this is really profound.
But then, I go back and forth. Yeah, it's got a nostalgic ring to that when you hear that. The sound of the lawnmower. I was like, oh my God. Yeah, but they're so, again, the levels that those things have to work on, where they have to be both of those things. Like, I could sit down, I feel like, and write a really dumb song right now. But I couldn't write a really dumb one that secretly kind of also connects to themes and is smart and has all this stuff. And make it catchy on top of that.
Yeah, I do think there's a kind of stoner profundity to some of the lyrics. And like the parts that get excerpted, like, how big am I? I mean, it's just like, yeah, good question. Like, you went to the right place. I don't know. I love it.
But then there's also ones like, I don't remember the title or the full sense, but the one about software. There's also like real straightforward, like, I could listen to that whole album over and over and over. It would be great.
Like, I think one person who's really bad at something is the saddest thing in the world if they keep doing it over and over again. But finding community in that together is the most joyous thing in the world.
Yeah.
You have to imagine the times that are not in this movie where they look at each other, they're like, we're pretty bad at this.
I don't know if they do that.
I don't know either.
Even on the airplane, they're like, you know, singing a song about Ishtar and, you know, as they're flying into, you know, it's just every single thing. Or like when he's sitting on the ledge, like, we haven't talked about, I guess, a lot of the movie. When he's sitting on the ledge feeling, I think, suicidal. And then he starts singing a song about sitting on the ledge, sitting on the edge of my life, you know. And you don't want to laugh, but it's like this guy is either deluded in that moment or that's just how he processes the world. Or, and then pretty soon he's talking about how he lived at home till he was 32 and he hasn't done anything with his life. And you're like, whoa. That swerved on me.
Yeah.
It's a really emotional scene.
Yeah.
It is.
Weirdly.
Yeah. And his parents are there.
Rabbi Peterson's here.
The sun will come out tomorrow. The rabbi comes out.
Yeah.
In that scene, at least, it feels like the movie is collapsing that distinction between, like, is this his delusion or is this just the way he processes things? Because there does seem to be something, and I don't mean this in a particularly, like, pathological, psychological way, but, like, compulsive about constantly translating situations into song lyrics.
Yeah.
And it's funny because the song lyrics are so often, like, so literal. It's just, like, anything is inspiration. But in that scene, like, to get past that sort of, like, veneer of artistic translation into the kind of, like, yeah, I'm a total loser, basically, the rest of, like, his admissions to Lyle, it's awesome. And, like, a moment when I know they're meant to be playing against type, and I wanted to ask both of you, like, what you think of that, like, how it works for the film and how it works for you. But in that moment, I feel like we're getting classic Dustin Hoffman, like, just wet eyes, super earnest, emotional high points, Dustin Hoffman, not like weird Lothario Dustin Hoffman.
Now I'm trying to think of a moment where we get Warren Beatty in the film. Like, is there a moment where, like, that shines through too? I don't know.
Yeah.
I think you're absolutely right with Dustin Hoffman, Veronica. Yeah.
Is it when he, like, says, are these breasts?
Yeah, probably.
Like, no,
Warren Beatty would have said it much differently.
You're right. It's a little clumsy for Beatty.
He would have been declarative.
These are breasts.
These are breasts.
The declarative. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. I do like that. I mean, I don't like. It's interesting that in both cases, yeah, that for one, I didn't know you could do this in a PG movie where she just lifts up her shirt. She has to prove to Dustin Hoffman that she's female. And then Warren Beatty somehow, that whole thing, and then all of a sudden he realizes she has breasts. So it's this weird thing where that's the only way she can prove her femininity to them.
Right.
And also really clumsy in a really bad 80s way with how they handle on that stuff. Like him thinking that he thinks he's just kissed a male.
Right.
You know, I mean, again, in the context of those times, I know that was happening more culturally, was like the message getting put out there, but still awful and not pleasant to see. And puts us a little, I mean, I don't blame the filmmakers, you know, and that kind of stuff. I think that kind of revisionist history is dangerous, but I do also think those parts I don't love.
It's interesting that you say that because I felt like watching that scene where Lyle has a kiss with Shira and then is like, oh, no, unless kind of thing. I thought that was like a lot less offensive than I was expecting it to be.
Oh, yeah. No, it could have been way more offensive. Yeah, sure.
Like that, it almost had this kind of like the end of Sun Like It Hot when he's like, I'm not a woman. And he's like, nobody's perfect. Like there's this kind of like weird permissiveness or like lack of homosexual panic or something happens in that moment for me that I was like, this is funny. And it just made me wonder, like, I mean, I've read that Beatty and Ajani were like not on super good terms despite dating. Their relationship was kind of exit ramping, but it just seemed like a moment where there was like some real levity in there somewhere, maybe off screen, maybe not in the cut that we saw, but it's interesting. And similarly, I was like, how racist is this movie going to be? Because before watching it, that's what I knew, is I was like, Ishtar, like, it's in North Africa, I don't know. And then when I was watching it, I was like, well, there's definitely a handful of scenes that I was just like, this is not funny to me. And especially durationally, like that were just quite long, like a scene where Chuck is pretending to speak various dialects and translate. And
the translator thing just did not age well.
It's I'm just like making sounds and saying it's language is, I mean, I guess that's literally what language is, but doing it for comedic effect is always makes me crazy. But apart from those moments, like it was a lot less odious, I would say, overall than I was maybe like expecting based on the subject matter.
Yeah, I think it's, I mean, it focuses mostly on Americans, even right. while they're over there. I think that's part of the way they avoid that.
It's a great point, yeah.
And I do think, I saw something in the doc, Frank, about like, yeah, when it, in some of the desert part, it kind of drifts for a little bit. Like, because we haven't, I mean, it's process-wise interesting that we haven't even mentioned the CIA yet 30 minutes into this recording.
Right.
Like, it's because it's part of the movie and it takes the plot to, you know, the road to Morocco type stuff and all that kind of. But it's not, I mean, unless Charles Grodin is in the scene, I'm kind of spacing out at those parts. I'm not really as right. into the parts where they're, I probably couldn't even explain to you the plot of what happens in that part, even though I've seen that 474 times. I was like, I know that someone's doing something and that someone else is doing something and that Charles Grodin is trying to get them to do something. You know, like, I get that there's plot stuff happening.
Amazing synopsis. I just political. Yeah, that's like Frank, espionage.
That's why I don't write the synopsis. Yeah. Yeah. And then this, and then more stuff.
It's true. It's true.
And then there's some things. But then, yeah, once it gets back to, I mean, it's almost that precise moment that Frank wrote about in the doc was that, yeah, there's something about, like, oh my God, we're going to miss our.
We're going to miss the show.
And then it's like, we're back. Okay. Let's back to the comedy. Let's go. And then, and that scene to me is so funny. That entire scene. When he thinks he's dead and the vultures are circling and then their big concern becomes like, this is going to ruin our career.
Right.
And there's, of course, no career to speak of. That whole thing is just...
How do you think this movie manages to do all of these things at the same time? And is it doing it in a way that creates this kind of like unsuccessful Gordian knot? Or is it deft and simultaneous in a way that's interesting? Because I'm one, it's like, you know, the artistic, do we have talent? Does it matter? We're still going to keep trying type of story. There's like the political conflict between getting recruited by the CIA and who is clearly like in cahoots with dictatorship or getting sort of radicalized and how these are made comparable as like equally manipulative kind of operations. There's the like homosocial triangle love story where Shira is desired by both friends. There's them keeping secrets from each other, which kind of routes through a couple of these. Like, how does the film manage all of these projects?
And the camel.
Camel. Yeah.
I don't know how to answer that, Frank. Do you? How does it do that?
I don't have any problem saying it doesn't fully manage it, because it doesn't. I think it's fair to say that like some of that stuff in the desert is just a little boring and it doesn't quite click. Even if it is a conscious effort on May's part to like mirror the road to Morocco stuff, like, the gropey and xenophobic stuff is when they're at their most Bing and Bob. I think there's still a lot of affection for that.
Mm-hmm.
So the film either way doesn't really make sense of it.
Mm.
But at the same time, I think the through line and baseline that these men are affectionately stupid is really interesting. This like this time watching through, we're like, they parrot so much of that information you were talking about, Veronica. Like when they're like just saying lines that Charles Grodin and Isabel Adjani had been saying to them. And I was like, oh, you know, in 2022, I do hear a lot of stuff that people are just saying from what they heard.
Totally.
I don't think it's a political point, but I do think Elaine May is conscious and receptive to all of those things. So the commitment to stupidity, I think, saves the film in the end.
I think that's amazing. As much sympathy as the film generates for the two characters and their stupidity in a sort of like interpersonal or like local sphere,
yeah.
I feel like it's also kind of like delightfully unsympathetic toward the United States and like U.S. sort of complicity. And like, it's really kind of like nudge wink about that. And also Charles Grodin, I mean, it's sort of like casting Martin Freeman in a role. It's like, you just want to be on his side, you know? Yeah. Really good, really soft spoken, but it's critical of that without sort of, I agree, like going to this sort of explicit ideological stance kind of place.
Yeah.
Well, just, and like the criticism that like the CIA is bad in 1987 isn't the most sophisticated, but like it's the background of the movie, right?
Yeah.
It's not supposed to occupy you. It is sort of the sort of ephemera of it.
Yeah.
It's also the seed of where, I mean, that was the original. She spoke with Mike Nichols in one interview about wanting to criticize the Reagan era.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Which, quick segue, Frank did cover an essay that he wrote this week for the site on Inner Space, which he has literally frames the whole essay through Ronald Reagan's Iran-Contra speech after, was the speech in 1987?
That was him like coming out being like, now you may have heard I've done some stuff, but don't worry.
Well, you referred to it as, there's this great phrase that going to butcher, but something about like how he's basically covering up the fact that he's not really saying anything, but he's saying a lot of words.
Yeah, yeah.
That speech.
Yeah, it's literally the scene they're watching at the end of American Psycho when Justin Theroux is like, look at this guy. He's like a cool old codger. Like, that's the one where like, oh yeah, that's the American Psycho. And then to see Grodin sitting, talking on the phone to Reagan in this movie. Oh.
Yeah.
Nice. Yeah. Oh.
There is that in there, but it's not predominant in the movie. But
yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's the sea that they're swimming in.
Turns out the CIA is bad, folks.
Breaking news. Yeah.
Frank, I would just love to hear you say a little about the film as a musical. I know we sort of touched on it before, but...
Yeah, oh, heck yeah.
What does having that as one of the possible genres kind of in the hybrid swirl do for you with the film?
I don't think it's out of off base to suggest it, right? Because she is very consciously working in genres, right? You have like the screwball of New Leaf and you have the rom-com and then you have this gangster picture and then you have this road movie, but it's by these song and dance guys. So as soon as you said like it's a musical, I went back to, I think it's in the doc, Rosenbaum wrote about musicals, Jonathan Rosenbaum. But like if the first form a musical takes is like the performance of the human body, right? And it's like a sports kind of like, I can't believe LeBron James and Fred Astaire can do that. The second is about sort of like Vincent Minnelli, like here is a world wherein reality isn't the same, right? Time moves differently, people move differently. And therefore we can get to some sort of, what does he say? The metaphysical states of being. The fact that Ishtar might be a musical and might allow for a relationship to art making where art does not have to be good, but that making art together with each other might be what you're good at. Like, I think these two guys, their real art is how they make bad art together, right? It's like all the community theater stuff and it's like all the like failed band camp stuff. But the fact that that's what it lands on, if that's the world we're working with, and especially because Elaine May is like this sort of tragic figure at the end of the day who never got to make her things and sort of Orson Welles, right? But like, that's a really generous viewpoint to put in your sort of, in your art. I mean, that's what your essay's about, Chad, right? But like, it's that like this generosity of spirit, even with the CIA in existence. And it comes out through songs.
And I think it's way harder than, I mean, I think, again, the easy move is to just make fun of these people.
Right.
Or even to let it slip. Like, I did try to watch to see, is there a moment when she kind of slips and reveals like some condescension toward, I just never, could never find it, even purposely looking for it. That's why I felt on somewhat safe ground writing that part of the essay, because I feel like there's nothing that would suggest that this was an accident. Like, you don't accidentally treat your characters this way for the entire movie.
Right.
There's I don't know what the point is necessarily, other than maybe it's to your point that, like, hey, their art is making bad art, and that can be a beautiful thing. So it circles back in around love and celebration of art, which I do believe Elaine May believes in. But she's also an interesting person, too, in that she's, at least nothing that I've ever read. I know she stopped giving interviews in 1967, so there hasn't been a lot to read, but she does not is not someone who strikes me as someone who's particularly vulnerable in her sharing of emotions in her own like interviews or whatever. She's not someone who's talking deeply about feelings. Everything she's always intellectualizing or poking fun at, or you know, in all the stories you hear about her, she's always got a quip, or you know, so she, I think she really uses that as a defense. So I think it's even more touching that she's able to say like, okay, but here's a movie where like there's some really easy targets, probably the easiest targets I've ever put on screen.
Yeah.
And I'm going to love these guys instead. And I think that that's just, I don't know where that came from. Like you said, she had plenty of reason to be mad at people. Or, yeah, I mean, she, at that point, Mikey and Nikki had been, what, 10, 15 years? I mean, it had already been a long time since she'd made a movie. It was like she was cranking them out. And this was the first time they gave her a ton of money. So the stakes were really high and she didn't know how to do a lot of it. And so there was some stuff there, but still she kept with... Or at least in the final edit, she went with like, I'm going to love these guys and that's going to be the theme. And it's going to end with how wonderful they are and they're going to get their montage at the end. Which again, if you watched out of context, you might be like, is this making fun of these people? But if you're watching the movie, it's absolutely not making fun of them. It's giving them their little, their dream come true. They, I don't want to spoil it, but they negotiate to have a concert.
Spoil it. What are you talking about?
Spoil it, Chad.
I mean, it's
came out in 1987. People have had plenty of opportunities.
I don't even remember the exact mechanism that I watched it last night, but the, because I don't fully understand the plot, is something where the CIA has to allow them to perform a concert as like payoff or something, or I'm not really sure what's happening there. But they have to do it, and the audience has to sit there, and Grodin gets that great line about, oh, that's the single.
They wrote the music and the lyrics.
And they've got the outfits on, and the songs are getting like the deluxe remastered versions of them. You know, like they're these big songs now and stuff.
Yeah,
it's just great. And you hear some songs you haven't heard the whole time. Yeah, it just really sends them off into the sunset, maybe. But I think in their heads, they do. And they're like, this is their big moment. And I think that they're like, not thinking about how they forced this all to happen, but that they've earned this through their artistry.
It is a last dig, though, right? Like, I have been in a Christmas tree shop and been like, is this album a psyop? Like, you find a CD and you're like, did the CIA produce this on, like, red? So, like, there is a score, and there is that Elaine May, like, meanness towards the structures that put some of these guys out in the world.
Oh, yeah, right? Yeah. Sure.
You can have affection for bad art, but the sort of mandate that it's released and getting the studio treatment is a little squirrely.
That's a good point.
I love that we get all these kind of instructive moments of reaction shots, both earlier in the film that are like, what the fuck are these guys doing? Like, all those shots of audiences just kind of like spacing out or just looking in like abject disbelief at what's going on stage. And then later, these sort of more tender moments, both of those feel, even though they are seemingly like opposed, like they're doing this kind of surrogacy for the film audience, where maybe initially we're like, I don't know about all that, you know? Like, what are they? These guys can't sing. And then as it goes on, I was surprised to feel so caught up in like sharing the pleasure at positive reception to what they were doing, which I think starts when they're doing that first performance and they decide to sort of like denigrate themselves to doing covers.
Right.
And people are like, oh, we really like that. And it's sort of like this funny, that's the moment where I was like, is this a movie about karaoke? Because it feels like it's really a karaoke film, at least in that first kind of sing-along moment. I was like, yeah, that is the moment that let people make bad art.
I mean, that's because their manager told them to do that, though. And so they're just like, okay, fine. He says to work it up. And it's funny because it's, again, I thought this was all the same night. Like, they just hopped back up on the stage. It's a different night at a different venue. So that means they went and planned what they did. It wasn't like, okay, well, we'll wing it. It's like, no, this is what we came up with when we had a week to prepare. We have a cover of this song, and it's got all these dance moves and these, you know, Koopa Koopa, all the noises that Warren Beatty has to make, which I'm sure he just had a hoot doing. But
oh, my God.
But yeah, that's when that was when I was all in on the movie the first time I watched it. I remember it was like when Warren Beatty starts doing the thing, I was like, oh, yeah, this is great. Whatever's happening here. Like, this is wonderful, and I'm here for this whole vibe.
I was gonna say, I'm not naturally charmed by these men. Like, it is an uphill battle for me to like get on board with Warren Beatty and Dustin Hoffman. Like, I think, Veronica, you were talking about like them cast against type and like how that works, and like, it does. I'm not sure how, but it does.
It's interesting. Have you ever seen a big sports car? Is like the funniest thing I've ever heard, you know? I think that was the first time in the movie that I like laughed out loud when I was watching it like on my laptop. Yeah, there's just an economy of humor to that is like so delightful to me. And I've never been kind of Warren Beatty pilled in terms of like his devastating attractiveness to like every woman ever, like in his heyday, I should say. But the idea that Dustin Hoffman is like the sort of ladies man, and that Warren Beatty is this like stage fright stricken hick. It's really, really, really delightful.
Ice cream truck driver.
Yeah. It's really delightful to me. I love how they play out the sort of like physicality of their differences. And I love the costuming of Dustin Hoffman in this film.
Yeah.
Love those headbands, ?
He's always doing this with his hair too.
You know? Really, yeah. Adjusting the bangs. I know all about that. Yeah. It's so good.
I know I always like to talk about how old the characters are in a movie and my own age, but like that is like me going out right now on the road and being like, I mean, they're in their 40s somewhere, and they're gonna go out and be like, this is the time to shine as rock stars and to dress. I mean, everything about that is so, again, so ripe for just brutalizing these guys in this movie. But it's never, I don't know what it is that makes it not. It might just be that there's no audience member yelling out, you suck really loud or something like that. It allows you to see that this is ridiculous, but it does not say, I'm now judging all these people for how ridiculous they are. Ha ha, we're better than you. I know, I keep coming back to that. But I'm just fascinated by that line that she can strike. I don't think that's an easy thing to do. And I can't really, off the top of my head, come up with other movies that present really unintelligent characters or deluded characters, but then just have all this affection for them. I'm sure there are. I mean, I'm sure it's not the first, but nothing's coming to mind. So
there is something really meta happening, though, I think. It's dumb characters that we end up feeling a lot of fondness for. And it's kind of a dumb movie that we're like spending an hour talking about because we feel a kind of fondness for it. And I wonder if that's all just packaged in that early and then recurrent song lyric that honest and popular don't go hand in hand.
Yeah.
That there's this kind of like self-acknowledgement on the part of the movie somehow that whatever it's trying to do is probably not going to hit, but it's going to have value anyway or something like that.
No, it is. There's this thing, right? But like, it's in that song, Veronica. It's the nobody knows where the beginning part starts out, but being human, we can live with the pain. Beyond even their belief that bad art can be good, there is the notion that profundity emerges in the act of performing.
Mm.
Like, it's almost trance-like what these guys are doing and the way the camera treats them, right? There is this sort of reverence. Like, Little Darlin', is that all one shot? Is it all like one, like...
I think so,
it just
yeah.
feels... It's like the opposite of what Warren Beatty is. And and he's not playing that, and he's not playing that. He's just sort of saying the words. I don't think there's a word for it.
Yeah.
I think they're doing it.
Ishtari.
Ishtari?
Pretty Ishtari. Yeah.
Forget it, Jake. It's Ishtari. Well,
Chad, you haven't said it's a movie yet, so did you want to get whether it is or is not a movie?
It's a comedy. Yeah, it is a movie. I have judged this officially a movie.
Okay.
I would say cinema.
Is it the only movie?
Is it the only movie?
I'm going to call it cinema.
Is it the only comedy she made? That's what I was going to say.
Oh.
I mean, it depends on how you define comedy, right?
Well, let's do it.
Do you not think A New Leaf is a comedy?
I think it's formally a comedy, but I don't laugh in it. It's mean. Isn't that the word you use in your essay? Like, there's a meanness.
I think it's mean. That is what I think. But I know lots of people who are like, oh, that whole, like, inside the Grecian nightgown scene just, like, really cracks people up. And for me, like...
I kind of recoil. I'm like, oh, there's something... Same. I think it's great, but I think it's like... I think it's like, whoa, this is weird.
Yeah, me too. Well,
but part of that is Walter Matthau is... openly hostile towards her and literally marries her to try and murder her and get her money. So there is a setup there that's
right.
inherently mean towards this character.
Well, and the same with Heartbreak, right? Heartbreak Kid is just like I don't laugh at all. That is a terrifying movie. That is a terrifying movie. Like, he turns into Jim Harrison. Like, Grodin walks into this movie, Lenny. Chad, is he the only, like, recurring character in the Elaine May
multiverse?
Universe?
Yeah,
the multiverse.
Charles Grodin?
Yeah. Or at least the only, like, big one?
I'm trying to think through the EMCU.
I love that.
I think that's good. I like that.
I mean, I'm certainly going to think of one as soon as we end this recording, but a lot of filmmakers that tend to work in the style that she does tend to have certain, like, kind of stock characters, like, whether it's Paul Thomas Anderson or Martin Scorsese, whatever. Or Altman. They'll carry you, like, okay, here's all these new people, but also here's my main people.
Right.
No, other than Grodin, I'm struck to think of anybody, and possibly total conjecture here, maybe... the experience of working on the Elaine May movie made people not necessarily want to sign up for it.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. It sounds like if the filmmaker is going through that much hassle at all times and is also, you know, rewriting. I mean, it doesn't sound like she would be easy necessarily to work with.
Right.
I think that's Soren may say too. She had a really hard time articulating what she wanted. She just knew in her head what she wanted.
Yeah.
And that's anyone who's been on the receiving end of that knows it's a very frustrating call to answer, Frank. I believe you've done some acting as well. If a director doesn't know what they want, but they really want you to do it, you're like, what do I do with that?
A line reading is easier. Just give me a line reading. Let's save 2 hours and give me a line reading.
Yeah, so it's just like, and I think that there's probably some element to that. She also, like, close friendships with anybody, but especially with, like, she doesn't have a lot of, like, close friendships that I've seen throughout a lot. I mean, obviously Mike Nichols.
Right.
And they had their falling out as well, too, and coming back together, thankfully. But yeah, I mean, when I interviewed Kenneth Lonergan, he did say, like, she was the antithesis of what everyone thought she was going to be, that she was so warm on the set. Everyone loved her so much. And I should say, context-wise, we're talking about the Waverly Gallery, which, you know, she shows up and wins a Tony in her late 80s for this, like, titanic performance that she has to do night after night of a woman descending into Alzheimer's. But I don't know if you guys read that, but he also said she very specifically, and this is, I will never forget this because Kenneth Lonergan also said, I've never seen an actor work like this in my life. Like, she would not, literally wouldn't walk into the room to do the scene unless she understood why her character would walk into that room. And not in a pretentious way that frustrated everybody, but in a, like, no, literally, I don't know how to act unless I understand fully what, and she would say, like, why is my character standing up from the couch here? And he'd be like, well, because... the theater is a fairly static medium, and if you guys all just sit there for 30 minutes, it's going to get kind of boring for people. And she's like, well, that's not why my character would stand up. You know, so it really talks a lot about, she really needs to know the reason. I'm not sure if I have a broader point here, but just that she has such an idiosyncratic way of working on almost everything she does. And I think that just, as much as that's part of what I love about her, I think that's probably what also just really just kind of tanked her career in all these ways, because the system and the studio, they're not looking for that kind of stuff. You know, they want deliverable, predictable results. And I know even the four films she does, like, find a through line through those. There's not much of one.
It does make sense, though, that with her background in improvisation and like skit comedy, that there would be like a real attentiveness to motivation. And I feel like that improvisational energy is something that's like so delightful in Ishtar, that you really get a sense of like a kind of spontaneous set of expressions, micro expressions and reactions and like treatment of silence and pauses and everything. I mean, all of that is just so granular in a way that I think is like actually comes across feeling really naturalistic, but also really composed, like selected from maybe like tons and tons of coverage.
Yeah, as opposed to like Anchorman, where they famously improvise like half of that movie, but you can all, it feels like they're improvising the entire movie.
Famously. A fact I've never come across somehow.
Yeah.
Rumor starts here.
And if you think a movie's trying to get you to laugh. Yeah. But yeah, I think there's a lot in there about the details too. I mean, she's very, very, like, that granular is a perfect word. There's not a lot that hasn't been thought through a lot in what she's doing. I don't always know why she does it, but I know that she has thought a lot about it. She's an artist. What are you going to do?
She's an artist.
Yeah.
Ishtar's a movie.
The notion that she could, that there's a different way to make a picture than the Hollywood model. Not a bad or a good way, that there isn't one way to do it, right? That's the Ishtar thing, right? Art can't be good or bad, but there can be alternative ways of making the art.
Well said.
Yeah.
Movie.
Have we talked about it? Is there anything we didn't hit? Or should we go to last call?
Should we do last call?
Getting the producer thumbs up, so.
Let's go to last call.
All right. Well, hopefully Frank is prepared.
Ding, ding, ding. Last call. Okay. So we typically end every episode by asking our guest, in this case Frank, to share the last thing they watched recently, not Ishtar, and then a quick staff recommendation. So Frank, what's something that you watched recently?
I just watched Opening Night, the Cassavetes movie, for the first time as a double feature with Ishtar, which is its own great pairing for, like, is art good? Can it be good? Is life bad? And maybe we should just laugh at it. So, I mean, it's devastating, but in a really fun way.
Yeah.
So that one. And recommendations, not a movie. Def Rec, Seduction, the book by Karina Longworth. Finally got to it. And to hear that voice, like, using a different medium and going through a longer form, but still attacking things the same way and having the same anxieties, has been such a dream. So Seduction. And then just go back and watch all the Jean Harlow movies. There it is.
Amazing.
Bombshell.
Did you listen to the Erotic 80s podcast?
I sure did. And I partly picked the book up because I have to wait for the Erotic 90s.
I know.
Erotic 90s.
Erotic. I was just about to do the same thing. Oh. I think it is so funny. It's so funny how she says,
I love it.
Erotic 80s. Erotic, like, it is 80s. So insane. I've never heard so much articulation in my life. It cracks me up every time.
Oh. It's good.
What, Veronica, was the verdict on, did you finish the show? Because I know I talked to you when you're in the middle of it and you were really digging it at the time.
Yeah, well, I feel like I really would like to know if the site is getting some traffic on the James Spader essay, because James Spader won her hottest erotic guy of the 80s or whatever, like, bracket.
He was the winner?
Yeah, obviously. Oh, yeah. Yeah, obviously.
That piece has always done fairly well. I mean, do you remember when you wrote it a while ago and I was like, oh my God, like, this is doing a lot of traffic in our world.
I know. For what I'm telling you, horniness is the way in terms of site traffic.
So this is a new theory. So you're saying that on the internet.
Yeah. I don't know if you know this, but.
Sex sells.
Yeah.
I bet we can commodify that. Let's do it.
Yeah. Yeah. Someone should think of how to do that. Oh yeah. So that's a wrap on Ishtar. Thank you everybody for humoring me by letting me talk about one of my favorite movies, and also Veronica for watching it. Frank for rewatching it. Frank for being here.
Frank for being
it's
here.
It's really, really been great to finally hear Frank in real time. I had a feeling it would be fun, and it was a lot of fun. So thank you, Frank, for being here. And also, could you let us know where we might be able to, like, find you online if you want to be known in that way?
Sure. Letterboxd.
Or anything you want to plug. This is your chance.
The metaverse, Chad.
All right.
Letterboxd, last name, and then first two letters of my first name. And then Brightwall Dark Room, honestly.
Yeah.
So it's pretty good.
Is the Tiny Mixtape stuff, is that site still up?
Yeah, they're still in hiatus, still figuring it all out.
But I mean, your writing would still be there.
Oh, yeah, it's still up on the internet somewhere.
That's all music stuff, right?
It's all music stuff. And then a piece coming out through Notebook in a couple weeks.
For movie. Oh, nice.
Awesome. Hey, congrats. That's great.
On John Boys. Like, what else is there in the world? So.
Wow.
That's amazing.
Oh, my goodness. You're going to get to write about... Oh, I mean, I guess you already have written on it. Probably written it, right?
Seriously. Yes, okay. And rewritten.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Feel free to take any of the Mariners piece one and repurpose it. It's fine. You have my permission.
No, it's in concert, baby.
Oh, all right. Yeah, and last question is how the Yankees doing? Sorry, Veronica.
Better today than yesterday. Yeah. Better today.
I don't know why you're saying sorry to me. I went to a Mets game like 2 weeks ago.
So you've gone to a game more recently than me.
Yeah. Take that.
Cool.
Yeah.
I was just thinking of your intro to your sports, to your Color of Money essay when you talk about all the sports.
TLDR, I hate sports.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, except I will say that, like, in New Orleans, I was watching everyone but me and my friend group play pool, and I was just like, I feel like I have a completely different perspective on this now that I've been, like...
Did you play?
Obsessively. No, I can't play, but I don't know. I said some dumb, probably misused pool lingo, but...
Kid's got to break like a sledgehammer.
Yeah, sledgehammer breaks. Yeah. On the snap!
Yeah, I don't even know what that means, but I
have no idea. Yeah, no.
Yeah.
Sports.
I've used that around my house, and my family just stares at me. So.
To read this month's issue full of film essays from the glorious movie year that was 1987, visit us at brightwalldarkroom.com. You can also find us on Twitter at BWDR and also at the BWDR podcast.
And please be sure to subscribe, share, rate, review this podcast. If you like it, tell a friend about it. Tell anyone you want. Actually, have our permission to just announce it to the world. Especially if you know someone who likes Ishtar, because it's been getting a little bit more coverage in the last few years, but it still needs a lot more. So a personal favor to me. Please tell them about our Ishtar podcast. If you hear it, share it with somebody. And you can also support us by going to our Patreon page, patreon.com/brightwalldarkroom, or by subscribing to the site. This month, obviously, we're doing 1987. And next month, we will be doing time travel, and that's going to be well worth checking out as well.
Our theme music is composed by Chad Perman. This podcast is produced and edited by Eli Sands. There was totally a moment when we were talking about like making bad stuff together or so, and I was like, is this a movie about podcasts? Is that what this movie is about?
Yeah.
Are we doing this right now?
Yeah.
A movie about us?